This podcast was recorded at the 2018 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Hollywood, Florida. To review the CE information and learn how to earn credit for JADPRO Live podcast activities, see the presentation material, or seek other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Denise Economo, and welcome to our CE Certified Symposium on Evolving Strategies to Manage Treatment-Related Events with Classical Hodgkin Lymphoma. The symposium is certified by the Annenberg Center for Health Sciences at Eisenhower, and to claim your credit, please follow the instructions on the sheet you received this evening. If you didn't receive a sheet, please let someone, one of us know, and we'll make sure the staff member will provide you one. We have two wonderful speakers for you tonight. Ms. Amy Goodrich is a nurse practitioner in the Hematologic Malignancies Program and Research Nursing Manager at the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center in Baltimore, Maryland. Ms. Goodrich manages patients with various types of hematologic malignancies, concentrating on the lymphomas. She also manages the Cancer Center's research nurses and is extremely involved in research operations. Dr. Jose Sandoval is an assistant member of Moffitt Malignant Hematology and Cellular Therapy at Memorial Healthcare System. He is a researcher whose focus is in prognostic and therapeutic aspects of lymphoid malignancies, with an emphasis in CLL and mantle cell lymphoma. His professional interests are in patient-focused care of all hematologic malignancies, with a special emphasis in both indolent and aggressive lymphoid tumors. Please welcome Ms. Goodrich and Dr. Sandoval. Thank you.
So we're here to talk about Hodgkin lymphoma. So learning objectives, we're going to talk about adverse events. We're going to talk about emerging therapies. We're going to talk about best practices regarding adverse events. We're going to talk about checkpoint inhibitors and immunotherapies, and then as well as patient education. So I hate to have you work, but I'm going to. You should all have a little keypad. If you can please indicate the role that best represents you, just so we know who's in the room.
Retro music.
Okay. And if you can also tell us about your practice setting. Okay, a nice combination there. If you can tell us about your clinical specialty. Great. And your years in practice, and I think that's the last question.
It is.
Wonderful. Okay.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you very much, JADPRO, for the invitation, and thank you for all you guys being here. I'm going to start here with a Hodgkin lymphoma, basic epidemiology of a disease. Hodgkin lymphoma, just for you guys to know, is one of my favorite diseases, one of my favorite patients to be seen, because it's very simple in a way. We're nowadays, with the current treatments, we're curing about 70 plus, 80% or more of these patients. So it's one of the refreshing time of the days. However, you just hear me saying around 80, 75, 80%. So there's still a fraction of patients who are not cured and actually are benefiting from the new advances of new medications that we're developing. So anyhow, let's get started here. So it's not a very common disease. Like you see, it's around like new cases in the U.S. in 2018, it will be about 8,500. And the deaths, it's around a little bit more than 1,000 patients per year here in this year. So it's a very curable malignancy. Still, we lose some of our patients to this tumor. It is an the age of diagnosis is it has a bimodal age. The median age at presentation is actually around 38 years old, but we have a first peak that is in the 30s, and then a second peak that is the most, actually, I would say is the most challenging population, that is a second peak around the 70s. Those are the patients with the sort of like more aggressive disease that you may. And the 5-year, in general, the 5-year overall survival by the year 2016 was more than 80%. Risk factors, they're not very well established with a lot of our hematological malignancies. They have socioeconomic factors have been described. Familial risk, certainly there's a cluster of families with a history of Hodgkin lymphoma that have a common predisposition. And certainly if the patient has a family member with a history of Hodgkin lymphoma, the risk increases by 2 or 3-fold sometimes. EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, very important. It is related with some of the Hodgkin lymphomas, especially one that is called lymphocyte rich. We see a lot of that around here in the Caribbean and Central and South America. 30 to 40% in Europe, North America, and up as high in 80% Central and South America, as you see here. Sometimes related to autoimmune disorders, tobacco use, not very straightforward, but important. HIV patients on antiretroviral therapy. Actually, this is not a sort of like a disease marker for AIDS. These patients actually develop more Hodgkin lymphoma when they have a good number of CD4 count. It has a lot of things to do also with the bone marrow microenvironment that I'm not going to touch base a lot on that right now. And also has two main important genetic drivers in this disease is the NF-kappa-beta pathway and the JAK-STAT pathway that acts actually in the gene. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. The gene that is right next to the amplicon that is right next to this JAK-STAT pathway is our gene for PD-L1, PD-L2 as well. That is very important in this disease. Again, 0.5-fold new cancers here in the States, a little bit more common in males than in females. We talked about bimodal age distribution. And the survival, you know, is quite a bit. So it is very important also the survivorship care of those patients. That's one of the main messages of our meeting today as well. Again, the most common Hodgkin lymphoma, mainly there are by the WHO, there are 5 types of Hodgkin lymphoma, but the most common one is what we call classical Hodgkin lymphoma. The other small portion that we're not going to talk about in this meeting is the one that we call nodular lymphocyte predominant, that I don't even know what is in this group. It looks more like a low-grade lymphoma, but that's a different category. Classical Hodgkin lymphoma, again, most common one, 4 main types. One, nodular. This is how we see the cells of Hodgkin lymphoma, how we see the disease under the microscope. This is a histologic classification. Most common one, nodular sclerosing, classical Hodgkin lymphoma. This is most common one in younger patients. The mixillary one usually has a characteristic that it usually involves a little bit more the liver. And it's also more common in older folks, as well as the lymphocyte-rich classical Hodgkin lymphoma, and that is also more related to EBV. And the most sort of like rare category is the lymphocyte-depleted classical Hodgkin lymphoma, most common in HIV patients. A little bit about the staging of the disease, again, from Ann Arbor staging, with the modification of the Lugano classification. So we have mainly Hodgkin is divided into a limited stage disease and advanced stage disease. Limited stage disease, stage 1 and 2, advanced stage 3 and 4. And on those, especially important for limited stage disease, we have unfavorable risk and favorable risk. Talking about unfavorable risk for limited stage, you can see bulky disease for your information. Bulky disease in most publications is referred as diseases or masses that are more than 10 centimeters in Hodgkin lymphoma. Like you see here, large mediastinal adenopathies that take more than 1/3 of the internal transverse diameter of the thorax. Also important when higher risk is when they have extranodal involvement. And also when they have four or more nodal sites of disease involvement. Most common site of extranodal involvement now in the PET era actually, well, aside from the more common than the bone marrow, is actually bone involvement and then bone marrow. As a tip, Hodgkin lymphoma very rarely involves the bone marrow. Other areas is lung, liver, and muscle. The ESR, or erythrocyte sedimentation rate, when it's elevated, especially more than 50, we know B symptoms is a high risk factor. Or when you have B symptoms or constitutional symptoms, and when the ESR is more than 30. Here are the classic B symptoms for you guys to review. I'm not gonna go through that one. I'm gonna go to the next slide. This is one of the most common prognostic score that we use in Hodgkin lymphoma, that is called the International Prognostic Score, or IPS. One thing is important for the IPS, is only validated for stage 3 and stage 4 Hodgkin lymphoma. You can count, it's 1 point for each factors. There are 8 different factors. Any 0 is excellent. More than 5 factors actually is a high risk, very high risk disease. But again, you can see, well, the difference, you can see the spread out curves. If you see the curves from the publication, they're very nice Kaplan-Meier curves there. But even patients that are 5 or more, more than 40% of patients are considered cured by 5 years or not. So Amy, did you guys use this classification of this staging to when you meet the patient initially?
We do, yeah, we definitely do, because it gives patients, they always want to, they think this is the good one, right? There is no good one, right? But, mm-hmm. You know, we do talk about these risk factors with patients so they understand, you know, where they sort of stand on our benchmarks.
Absolutely, and this is important also for a couple of new interventions that nowadays have been approved for the treatment of Hodgkin lymphoma in the first line that we will talk a little bit later. Yep. But also something that I want to point out, these are very sort of like bedside measurements that actually you can do with a complete metabolic panel. And with a physical exam and a CBC and a physical exam, you can determine these factors of risk for patients. What are we missing here that are very important prognostically nowadays? PET scans, okay? PET scan is extremely important in Hodgkin lymphoma. So next slide here. Okay, I'm gonna start talking about first line therapies of classical Hodgkin lymphoma. These are line here is the one where you guys probably are very familiar with, that is ABVD, it's like my ABC. And usually we use between 2 to 6 cycles, depending if it's early disease or advanced stage disease. And the medication says for Adriamycin, otherwise called as doxorubicin, B for bleomycin, dreaded bleomycin, bimblastin, and dacarbazine. Probably dacarbazine is one of the only, aside from in the past, stage 4 melanoma, is the only, probably only one of the only malignancies that we use dacarbazine. It's time for 5, an old regimen. I actually have never used it myself. We were talking with Amy that I guess I'm too young to have used a stem for 5.
I'm but, not too young, but...
But it's a very heavily treated, heavily uploaded treatment. That the main thing about this is that it has a medication that is called meclaretamine, very related to a lot of second cancers, and also it's also related to infertility, and also this schema also has embedded on the schema itself radiation therapy. So that's one of the main differential factors for this STAMP4-5. BCOP is a German protocol. It's between 2 to 6 cycles, and we use it. We know as a BCOP or escalated BCOP. We will talk about it a little bit because it had very interesting results. But it's a very heavy chemotherapy regimen, related a little bit more than ABVD with secondary malignancies and so forth. And I don't know. I don't use it a lot. I have used it, but I don't use it a lot. But if you have used it, you'll see that this. It's not for everybody, okay? It's only for the very hard. Involved site radiation. One of the things that I want to tell you guys is that radiation is very, I would say, very non-popular here in the U.S., but I believe is very, very, very important, especially for patients who have limited stage disease, but especially patients, especially males, and especially things that are not around your chest or mediastinum. But otherwise, it's extremely important in my point of view. And then brentuximab vedotin is one of the new kits in the block for frontline, recently approved by the FDA with the combination of AVD. We will talk maybe about it a little bit later. It's approved for stage 3 and stage 4 disease and patient with IPS more than 4. That's what I was telling you, that is important in that sense. Brentuximab vedotin, we will talk about that medication a little bit later on. Doxorubicin, vinblastine, and dacarbazine. Just a tip for you guys, never, ever, ever use brentuximab with bleomycin. That's what you don't want to see, because the pulmonary toxicity is prohibited. Okay, that's why we don't use it in that regimen. Next, back to you, Amy.
Okay, so ABVD. Who treats Hodgkin's patients in here? Okay, so most of you, so you know ABVD, right? You know the schedule, it's every 2 weeks, every day 1 and 15, but all of these patients, any patient you have with lymphoma really needs a good workup initially. Certainly all of the HIV and hepatitis testing applies to all patients. For these folks, again, that bimodal distribution, fertility considerations are very important for that first peak of folks that you're going to see, not so much for the 65-year-old, although it may be. As you've seen, all of these regimens have an anthracycline, so you need to understand people's cardiac function. And for the regimens that use bleomycin, certainly getting PFTs with diffusion information is important. There are some dose adjustments here for creatinine clearance. For creatinine clearance, you're going to stop the bleo if there's any suspicion of lung toxicity, and then you're going to adjust for liver function studies. And then the dacarbazine, you guys know this, it's very irritating. Most patients that I treat don't need lines, but occasionally you get somebody who just can't tolerate it. So adverse events, again, you're seeing these patients, lots of nausea with this regimen, and I don't know if you're seeing this, but in my younger patients, they tend to have a lot of anticipatory nausea and vomiting, which Ativan works beautifully for, but it is sort of a unique issue with them and not so much the older folks. Infusion reactions, we don't give test doses of bleomycin. Does anybody give a test dose? Do you have a test dose, Jose?
Yes.
You do?
We still give it in there.
Yeah, we don't do that. I guess that's a preference thing. You guys are giving this regimen, so you know that many times they're coming in, they're neutropenic, they're due for their treatment, you treat them, their counts come back up, and they have very little trouble with infections or neutropenic fevers, which is very nice. Again, don't give oxygen with bleomycin. Hopefully everyone knows this. And when we talked about the brentuximab with AVD, that's a great option for your patients who come in on oxygen for some reason, usually the older folks. We've got lots of them who come in with their oxygen tanks. That's a great regimen for those folks to avoid the bleomycin. So you're looking for cough and really subtle. These can start out very subtly, just cough, a little dyspnea on exertion. Steroids usually take care of this, but you're going to look at PFTs and chest scanning. And then you're going to get rid of the bleomycin if there's any question that it is bleotoxicity. So nausea and vomiting, again, highly emetogenic regimen. You're going to do the right thing. I'm sure you've all got sort of a cookie cutter regimen of antiemetics that you're using, but it's not uncommon for these people to have to get stepped up or need to get some Ativan or lorazepam added for their anticipatory nausea and vomiting. Hydration. Patients always want to know what they can do. I say wash your hands and hydrate, right? That's the one thing, the two things they have control over. And really you're just trying to make sure they're not dehydrated. And then the counts that go up and down, like I said, very little neutropenic fever. They can be anemic and thrombocytopenic. Very few of these people are going to end up needing transfusions. Occasionally you have a one-off, but they're rare. And you're just going to be watching their counts and you're going to be doing the right thing, and they know you need to educate them on what they're looking for, and you need to be doing your part here. The other thing, and this is more for older folks, these vitamin deficiencies, don't ever forget about those, because that can be a very common cause of anemia in our patients. And then same thing for thrombocytopenia, we sort of get lax with this sometimes, but the men need to, and the women, get rid of your razor, those practical sorts of things.
Okay, so let's make a couple of, before I advance, I want just to see a couple of arms. Who of you guys who treat patients with ABBD always include growth factors on that protocol? Raise your hand. Okay, not a lot. So there's we can, of course, but there's a teaching, another tip that I want to give you guys, that the main, sort of like the secret ingredient for ABBD and the cure for lymphoma is twofold. One, the biology of Hodgkin, of course, that gladly we can treat and we can cure in a large portion of our patients, but also the treatment intensity as well. Okay, so it's fair enough to, it's completely normal, and please, actually, we should encourage not to use a lot of growth factors in these patients, especially if you're using ABBD. Okay, bleomycin and growth factors, like Amy was pointed out, is very, it's been related to more pulmonary toxicity. And also, we really don't need to use growth factors in this patient, yes, as such. Even in patients that are neutropenic, we should go ahead and treat them, regardless of those counts. However, you should use growth factors if the patient has an episode of febrile neutropenia. That's a different story. I just want to make that clear. Yep. Okay. German Hodgkin Lymphoma Study Group HD10 is a very important trial. You don't have to remember the name of the trial, but it was a very large phase 3 trial in Germany, where sort of like defined one of our algorithms and our standards of care for early stage Hodgkin lymphoma. They compare all those different groups of ABBD, 2 cycles versus 4 cycles, but different doses of involved field radiation therapy. And you can see that, I can tell you the gist of it, is that patients with earliest stage, with good prognostic earliest stage Hodgkin lymphoma had the same 5-year overall survival when they received 2 cycles of ABBD versus 4 cycles of ABBD. And when you compare 20 grays of radiation versus 30 grays of radiation, that's the good prognostic patients. If, however, you have patients with a bulky mass, or who have unfavorable disease, you can, let it very localized, you can go ahead and do 4 cycles of ABBD and radiation. Here in the United States, I don't think we're going to talk about that right now. What we usually tend to do nowadays, especially with PET-guided therapy, we usually do, if you have bad prognostic early disease with bad prognostic features, we can use between 4 to 6 cycles plus or minus radiation therapy for bulky masses. Or if you have localized disease with good prognostic features, we follow, I believe we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but 3 cycles, you see the PET negative, radiation, 1 more cycle and radiation. So it's a little bit different, the focus with you here, than in Europe. But remember, if you want to use for an early stage Hodgkin patient with good prognostic features, only 2 cycles of ABD plus a low dose radiation, it works really, really well, and you can see the table there. I'm just going to breeze through it. Stanford 5, I don't know if you guys, somebody still use it. It's a very, I will put it, challenging regimen. And believe me, it's very hard for the fertility of our young patients. Okay, so, I mean, we don't use it in our institutions. Yeah. I don't know, I know Hopkins, they use it, I mean. BCOP, very important for us here in the United States, very important salvage regimen. I can tell you that in Germany, they use it quite a bit. They have 2 different sort of flavors of BCOP, one that is escalated BCOP and the other one is a standard BCOP. The difference is on the doses of the etoposide, the doxorubicin, and the cyclophosphamide, okay? So in patients that are high, sort of the scenarios that I have used this protocol is when patients, for example, high-risk patients with stage 3 or stage 4 disease, they undergo 2 cycles of ABBD, and they still have very clear positive PET scans, okay? I don't know if you guys remember, that the way we quantify these PET scans are with something that's called the Duvial score, or DS score, from 0 all the way to 5. So if we have a score of 4 or 5 after the 2 cycles of ABBD, so the patient is clearly positive from the PET scan point of view, sometimes one of the things that you can do is to escalate therapy with BCOP, either escalated or standard with BCOP. I only use it, like you see in the left column, I only use it in patients that are young and they have good performance status. It's also a hard therapy to use, and do not use it in patients with immunosuppression status like HIV patients. It was not approved and not validated in that context. Do you guys usually use a lot of that protocol?
We use it when we have to, right? Because you can see this treatment-related mortality is really quite startling for your older folks. So these are patients, who, again, younger. And when you give two cycles of ABVD and the PET is still positive, you don't give six cycles of BIACOP, you give four. So you get away with a little less toxicity than is reflected on this slide, but only when you have to, because it is not an easy regimen.
And also, yes, last point about this slide, these patients also have a little bit of longer-term toxicities, like second malignancies, myelodysplastic syndromes, AML, and so forth. And the procarbazine has been related to other malignancies, things like we didn't even expect, but there are very large Dutch registries have been related to, for example, stomach cancer, lung cancer, and so forth. So it's very effective, but it has its own implications, yes. So Kigwa-Wei talks of first-line therapies for classical Hodgkin lymphoma. The majority of classical Hodgkin patients will be cured with initial therapy, 80% or so. However, we still had that 15 to 20% of folks that are those diseases that are the bad players. All regimens are toxic, and we need to respect them, and they have potential for significant side effects during and after therapy. And ongoing improvements in the prophylaxis and treatment of therapy-induced side effects may be guideline-driven. The best thing in a lot of these side effects is prevention. Okay, prevention, choose the right patient with the right comorbidities to give XYZ treatment. And all you guys, nurse practitioners, advanced practitioners, they play a very important role in educating the patients and families, especially on the first time that you see the patient, diligent monitoring of all the side effects and symptoms, effective management of side effects, and assuring optimal treatment outcomes of these patients. Second line treatments of immune therapy, if you go ahead, Amy.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So these are commonly used second line therapies, and in the bold are the ones that are most common. So DHAP, ESHAP, BGEV, other gemcitabine based regimens. ICE is very common. Brentuximab, Vedotin plus chemotherapy. Auto transplant comes in here as well after second line. And then allo is typically third line and beyond. So the general principles for relapse refractory Hodgkin. So you are considering the pattern of relapse. What drugs did you use before? Really, how long was that first remission? That is really a very telling timeline for patients. Those who have primary refractory disease have a very dismal prognosis. So allo stem cell can be considered after auto, if you can get somebody into remission third line or later. BV is a treatment option if auto has failed or if two prior multi-agent regimens have failed. So again, nivolumab and pembro as well are options for patients after second line, third line, and beyond. So those are our key points here. Brentuximab.
Let's talk about this molecule that is very, very interesting. I don't know if you agree, Amy. So brentuximab vedotin is one of the first drugs of this class of antibody drug conjugates. Definitely the first one in our realm of malignant hematology. It is an antibody that targets CD30 that is expressed on these classical Hodgkin lymphoma cells that are called the Ritz-Steinberg cells. It targets CD30 that is a member of the tumor, the TNF family, and is expressed on all Hodgkin cells. And it combines a potent anti-tubulin agent that is called monomethyl adrostatin. With a CD30 chimeric monoclonal antibody. So mainly, if you see here to my right side of the slide, The antibody has it has a payload, like generally four molecules of this MMA. Antimicrotubulin agent is say like a vincristine or pimblastine, but in a very miniature size. And it's attached by a linker. The linker is the key here, because this company work a lot of times in trying to make the good linker for that toxic molecule to be attached and not disseminated in the body and cause extra toxicity. And then when it binds to the CD30 receptor on these Hodgkin lymphoma cells, it gets internalized in the cell through the lysosome. The lysosome it goes into a vesicle, then it attaches to the lysosome, and the lysosome gets rid of the linker, and the monomethyl mandostarin gets released into the cell and attacks the tubulin complex. One thing that I will tell you is that, yes, you have to remember that inside, let's say, a lymph node of Hodgkin lymphoma patient, there's only about 1% or less of these Rydsteinberg cells. It's all a milieu of immune cells and fibroblasts and a lot of different components, but only about 1% or less actually are these tumoral cells. So this therapy also has some other sort of effects around the microenvironment of the Hodgkin tumor as well. So very interesting compound indeed.
Sure. So brentuximab it's been around now since 2011. The current indications are failure after failure of auto. So in transplant ineligible patients who are heavily pretreated, and post auto in people that are at high risk for relapse after transplant. And so you see the dosing 1.8 mgs per kg. There's some dose reductions, and it's contraindicated concomitantly with bleomycin, which Jose has already mentioned. So when you look at side effects of brentuximab, it's all about counts, right? But then look at the second one down. So peripheral neuropathy, if you add the sensory plus the motor, that's 60%. So 60% of your patients are likely to develop some degree of peripheral neuropathy. Fortunately, only 13% will be severe, but that is definitely the most common side effect of BV. And then, you know, the fatigue issue is real, pyrexia, nausea, diarrhea, bowel changes. You know, none of this is out of the realm of what we're used to, but that's a really high peripheral neuropathy rate. In looking at BV after transplant, so this is a study that looked at folks who were high risk for progression post-auto, and they were randomized to either get BV maintenance or placebo. And so, as you can see from this slide, the progression-free survival is improved for patients who got BV, but the overall survival, there's no difference. So you really need to choose carefully which patients. These have to be your really most high-risk patients that you're worried about relapsing. These can't be people who have baseline peripheral neuropathy. But you know, they go ahead, Jose. I know you wanted to make some comments here, but you know, it's kind of a hard sell to patients, so you have to spin it just the right way for your most high-risk patients, because they get done with that auto and they just want to get on with their life, right? They don't want to be coming back and getting strapped down to IVs again in your clinics, even though they like all of you, right?
Especially young adults, right?
Yes.
they don't want to be bothered.
Yeah.
Anyways, yep. Yeah, a couple of points about this. This trial is a famous trial in our field. It's called the ATHERA trial, initially published here in 2015. And yes, indeed, it showed a PFS improvement for 16 doses or 1 year of brentuximab vedotin maintenance after transplant. And the criteria for how to choose the patients for this, there are three main criteria. One of them, early relapse, meaning that the Hodgkin lymphoma came 12 months or less after the patient was on remission. The other one is primary refractory Hodgkin lymphoma. Or the third one is a relapse with extranodal disease, okay? Those were the one, you have to have one of those criteria to be included in the trial. Then the update of this trial just came was just published last month in Blood. No, actually early this month in Blood, early on October in Blood, and it still shows just a benefit of PFS. So with the therapies that we have right now for Hodgkin lymphoma, I don't think we ever gonna see an improvement in overall survival in this population. So I really, like Emmy was saying, I really choose the patients that I want to put on this treatment. There are some other centers that are more liberal, and they say, like, I will put almost every single patient on this treatment. But really, on the people who work the most is in patients that have one of those criteria, okay? So again, people who relapse less than 12 months after they were in initial remission, patients who relapse with extranodal disease, on patients who actually relapse, who have primary refractory disease. And if you go to the nitty-gritty of the data, actually the people who got the best of all are the patients who have two or most of these risk factors. So, and it has certainly side effects, right? Like peripheral neuropathy, a lot of my patients cannot finish this treatment because especially the peripheral neuropathy is involved in it. But.
Okay, so peripheral neuropathy. We all know about peripheral neuropathy. It is very common in our Hodgkin patients because of the neurotoxic drugs that we're giving them. It's most commonly sensory. And as you all know, this can last for days, months, years, and people can be left with peripheral neuropathy permanently. I think the hard part about these people with Hodgkin's, like we keep talking about, this is a curable disease, and so pushing through and giving full dose and dose density and all of that really is important. So you have to be assessing very carefully and peeling off and dose reducing very carefully for these patients because we know it has a really horrible impact on their quality of life. And so the best thing we can do is assess and dose modify appropriately. So management of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. So prevention. When somebody cracks the nut on this one, we are all in for a treat. Us, right? But think of our patients, too. We, meaning collectively, are all in for a treat. There have been countless things studied trying to prevent peripheral neuropathy. Nothing has worked. And so there is no prevention for peripheral neuropathy other than early detection and appropriate management from there. I'm really looking forward to somebody fixing that. When we look at third line and beyond, again, bolding the common ones. So brentuximab, bendamustine comes to the scene, and this is where we get our checkpoint inhibitors. But you can also see, again, there's lenalidomide there, everolimus. There are some different drugs that come into the scene, third line and beyond. And you know, when I started in oncology, nobody got to third line and beyond. And now we have a whole buffet of options for these patients, which is really great.
Okay, so you know, going into the third line and coming soon, second line and maybe even first line, the microenvironment of Hodgkin lymphoma is an enriched microenvironment for the development of new therapeutic options for our patients. Like tailoring the therapy to the tumor biology of the patient may improve outcomes. That is, I wouldn't say it's wishful thinking. Actually, it's a reality that is probably going to come soon rather than later. That you see, that's a very busy picture there, but it's a very nice. It's a very nice review paper, actually, of all the potential pathways that we could sort of like target in these patients, especially the ones that we are very interested on, and one that we are already exploring is that the pathway here, is very, very far away. Sorry about that. But for example, if you direct your attention to the PD-L1, PD-1 pathway, these Ritz-Stenberg cells are enriched with expression of these PD-L1, PD-L2receptors. So it's just, it was a great story of translational research that went to our patients that has been extremely successful. Also the JAK-STAT pathway with our JAK-STAT inhibitors that I think they're in their infancy at this moment in time. And a lot of other things that we can use, immunomodulators and so forth and so on. We're just going to concentrate right now on these checkpoint inhibitors that you guys that also treat solid tumors are very familiar with. But I can tell you one thing, the cancer that has the best response to checkpoint inhibitors is Hodgkin lymphoma. Okay, I'm just saying. But anyway, some other new agents that are coming soon to this realm, and some of the ones that are pointed up here, actually, we're already using, like, for example, brentuximab vedotin, that is an antibody drug conjugate targeting CD30, nivolumab and pembrolizumab, PD-1 inhibitors. Okay, rituximab in Hodgkin lymphoma. Some of the Hodgkin lymphomas express CD20, that is our target for rituximab, that is very common in low-grade and high-grade non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And people have used actually rituximab in Hodgkin lymphoma, but I can tell you there's a recent randomized phase two trial from MD Anderson that in ABVD with or without rituximab, they really work. So I wouldn't recommend it at this moment in time. However, you're gonna see some other experts that they still will recommend for some patients this antibody. Galiximab is an antibody that is in development in CD80. Older microenvironment targeting therapies, lenalidomide immunomodulator, of course you guys know, very famous in multiple myeloma, MDS, and other therapies. Also nowadays in relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, has some activity in Hodgkin lymphoma, as usual, between 20 to 30% of response rates, but is definitely not a home run there. HDAC or histone deacetylase inhibitors like ponabinostat, they're also in development, but we don't have a lot of information right now. And other inhibitors of signal pathways, for example, mTOR inhibitors of everolimus, me myself, in my opinion, I believe those medications are very sort of like dirty medications. They don't really target very well that pathway. They have some activity, around 30% overall response rates in Hodgkin lymphoma, but not very effective. And AKT MAP inhibitors, I really don't have a lot of information from that because they're still in development in this malignancy per se.
Okay, so nivolumab. So who treats solids, Chu?
Okay, good. So wow. You guys, this is great. So I don't treat solids. So this was all new to me. So you guys have a serious, do you treat solids, Jose?
No.
Okay, all right. So this is all new to us. But anyway, so nivolumab came to Hodgkin's in 2016. It's indicated for relapse or progression after auto and post-transplant BV. Mm-hmm. Or three lines or more, that one should include an auto, but you know, we all have patients who will never get to transplant that we can easily get this approved for as well. You guys know the dosing because you're giving this to your solids. Again, this is the phase one study that was done. 104 patients, but only 23 of them had Hodgkin's. They were, actually 20 had classical Hodgkin, relapse refractory. 78% of them were post-auto, 78% were post-bendamustine. And look at that overall response rate, 87%. You don't see that in your solids, do you? Mm-mm. Nope. So at 7 years, 5 progressed, 5 went on to transplant, and 10 are still responding. They're still in remission. So this really revolutionized the care of these patients who really 5 years ago, we had nothing for them. So this has been great. This is CheckMate 205. Do you want to talk about this, Jose?
CheckMate 205, absolutely. I love this trial. You know, yeah. It's a phase two trial of nivolumab, sort of like hammering in the effectiveness of these treatments. These are patients, very heavily treated patients. Certainly, most of them treated after transplant. Or after 2 or 3 lines of therapies, overall response rates of almost 70% and CR rates of 16% and PR rates of 53%. You can see those nice curves explaining there. Of course, like a lot of our malignancies, the old American way, the more is better. Of course, if you have a better response, a CR response, these patients last longer on remission, of course. I don't know, and you guys have definitely more experience than us. You guys know how tricky it is sometimes to evaluate the response of in solid tumors, to evaluate the response to a checkpoint inhibitors with images, especially with PET scans. So we have to be very, very, very careful about the evaluation of these patients. This is less common than, for example, in lung cancer or melanoma, for that matter. But this phenomenon of pseudoprogression, actually, we also see it in Hodgkin lymphoma, especially we see a lot of inflammation. These are very inflamed tumor, okay? So we have to be very careful with that. We sometimes actually continue, unless the patient has new lesions, of course, Even if some of the previous lesions were growing or are more hot in a way, we sometimes continue. And there are some studies that actually say that you can continue this one in Hodgkin lymphoma as some other studies in solid tumors. So extremely, extremely active treatment. And you see a median overall survival in this trial was not reached, and 1 year overall survival, 92% in very heavily treated patients. In the CheckMate 205, main side effects are similar, actually, to the ones that you see with other PD-1 inhibitors. Mainly, one of the ones that we don't realize sometimes is fatigue. Okay, patients complete remissions, doing absolutely great, but they feel fatigue. And obviously, not a lot of infusion reactions. I mean, he's going to talk about that in a minute. And there's not a lot of discontinuation because of adverse reactions, only 17 patients. And they were actually because of immune-related side effects, 2% because of pneumonitis. We used to see that more often than colitis with the PD-1 inhibitors, and autoimmune hepatitis, 1 patient. Serious drug-related reactions, most of them were also, not most of them, but 1% was pneumonitis, and the other ones infusion-related reactions, not that very common, pneumonia, pleural effusions, and pyrexia.
All right, so pembrolizumab, again, you guys are treating your solids, you know this. This came to Hodgkin's in the beginning of 2017. So the spin here is that it's still for folks who have multiply relapsed disease, but then the pediatric angle comes in. This is approved for kids, for those of you who cross paths with pediatric oncology. The dosing is the same as what you're used to in your solids. And then if you look at overall response rate from this trial, 73% for those who had been transplanted, 64% for patients who couldn't get to transplant, had progressed after BV, and then for patients who had transplanted but had not gotten post-transplant BV, 70%. So all of those numbers are really quite impressive. Complete response rates of about 22%, PRs of almost 50%. So again, in a very heavily pretreated patient population, these are great numbers. Again, treatment-related adverse events. This is really typical of what you're seeing in your solid tumor patients, thyroid dysfunction, fevers. Only a little less than 5% discontinued therapy because of adverse events. There were no treatment-related deaths. So this is just a beautiful AE profile for this drug in this patient, and has great, great, great efficacy. And so AEs associated with immune checkpoint inhibition. So it's an augmented immune response driven by T cell activation that creates all these autoimmune inflammatory states in various tissues. And I do like this slide because, you know, these are all the systems you're looking at, and you're looking at that in all your solids. And I mean, we're giving these drugs like water now, but this is new to us in heme malignancies, but so be it. Infusion reactions. So these are uncommon, about 10% of patients, but it seems like less than that. You guys know what to do. You do the right thing. You stop the drug. Try not to use steroids if you don't have to. Have emergency equipment available. So you also know this because you're giving this to your solids, and this is an IPI slide, but it still is applicable to the drugs that we're giving in Hodgkin's. So these don't happen out of the gate. They can happen weeks and even months afterwards, rash, liver toxicity, colitis, you know, all of those things that we're looking for. So the treatment of severe and steroid refractory immune-related adverse events. And this is really cookie cutter for your solid tumor patients. If you've got grade 3 or 4 toxicity, you're admitting folks, you're doing the right thing, you're hydrating them, you're giving them steroids. And then in the little, oh, I guess that's gold, I don't know, goldenrod color.
So South Florida is gold.
Okay. So there are other, you know, depending on which adverse event folks are having, you can use a little different mix of these agents. And then really the key is they've all gotten steroids, they're all on pretty high dose steroids, and you just have to taper them down slowly. And if people flare, you re you escalate the steroids to try to get things under control again. And then hopefully everybody's got mechanisms to do this, and you know, this is like old hat to people at this point. Do you want to talk about sure. immune modulating?
Absolutely. The mechanism of actions of these immune modulator medications, steroids, we're very, very, very familiar with steroids. They have multiple effects on both our T cells and B cells. They're mainly lymphodepleting agents in a way. And also through phagocytes, NK cells and macrophages, they work through inhibition of transcription, interleukins, reduction of synthesis of cytokines, and inhibition of neutrophil apoptosis, and reduce macrophage function. Woof, that's a mouthful. Well, we use a lot of steroids anyway. You know, infliximab is a tumor necrosis factor inhibitor, initially approved, like you guys know, for rheumatological conditions, but it's one of our key agents where we're treating grade 3 or grade 4 immune side effects for these checkpoint inhibitors. One tip as well, the only one, I should have made that a question, but you guys probably know this better than us, for solid tumors, the only immune-related side effect that you should not use infliximab on is hepatitis, all right? That one you can use mycophenolate, mofetil, and whatnot. That is the mechanism of action of mycophenolate, mofetil, MMF as well, and it's mainly a nucleotide production inhibitor on lymphocytes. And tacrolimus and cyclosporine, they're calcineurin inhibitors, very familiar with that on our community for transplant, limits transcription of IL-2 involving T-cell proliferation. Mainly the ones that we use for these side effects are steroids, anti-TNF inhibitors like infliximab, and in some cases of hepatitis, mycophenolate mofetil as well. Okay, so keys to optimal management of patients with immune checkpoint inhibitors. Time to onset of adverse events are they're usually delayed, so we have to be very cognizant and very vigilant of those side effects. I have a personal experience of a patient that came with colitis back when I was in Moffitt working in the emergency department, a melanoma patient came with a colitis, grade 3 colitis, after I believe it was 10 or 11 months after being on combo ipi-nivo. A little bit strange, but you know, can happen. Education, times 3 of healthcare team, patients and caregivers, very important. Subtle symptoms may be the signs of initial presentation. The patients are, at the very beginning in those clinical trials, there were some fatalities because we didn't know about these side effects, unique side effects, so rapid and timely interventions had changed the natural history of these side effects. The steroids is the cornerstone for some intolerable grade 3 side effects, and any grade 3 or 4. For the grade 3 twos, you can start with oral steroids, of course, prednisone, and grade 3 and 4 is usually IV, methylprednisolone, and so forth, and slow taper of steroids with 4 to 6 weeks of a steroid taper. And reinitiation of treatment may be possible, especially when you use PD-1 inhibitors. EP is a little bit more difficult, but especially when PD-1 inhibitor, especially when the patients have grade 2, sometimes grade 3, but especially grade 2, you can reinitiate this one. Let me see. One thing that I want to mention before I go back to Amy and this is that especially in patients with colitis, we don't see that common. It's not that common with PD-1 inhibitors. More it's common with EP, ipilimumab. But remember, you're entitled to have multiple things, okay? So when patients come at the very beginning, it's not right away steroids, okay? Then you have omega colon for C. diff and, you know, you're done. So remember, work up the patient, okay? Some people are advocating sometimes even for sigmoidoscopies in these patients because there's some, they have found some features of that. For example, patients with ulcers on the sigmoid, sometimes they don't respond as well to steroids, and then you go to infliximab. There are some little pearls there, but remember, we need to see this patient as a whole, not just as a patient getting a checkpoint inhibitor. So
my pearl here is that when you have these young folks, because this reminds me of a patient of mine, a 20-something year old, he was on a trial getting ipi and nevo, and he got a terrible rash, and so we put him on steroids, stopped the ipi, and then he was just on nevo. He stayed on the study, he's just on nevo. he came in several cycles later saying, you know, I had really bad diarrhea, and I just took those leftover steroids, and it all went away. Like, oh, my gosh. And now his wife is pregnant, too. So anyway.
Side effect of the steroids.
He's like the patient from, you know. So, pregnancy. So, these are young folks. They should not be getting pregnant. Men or women should not be. They should all be using birth control. Make sure you're screening your young patients. I know we're all, you know, we're used to older folks, but these really, those younger patients, you really do need to think about them a little differently. So, checkpoint inhibitors and allo transplant. Who does allos here? Okay, so a smaller group. So there is this phenomenon now that is coming forth of patients who get these checkpoint inhibitors with Hodgkin to get into remission, to get to allo, which is a great thing. But there's an increased incidence of toxicity-related deaths during allo transplant, and what they typically are hyperacute GVHD, severe acute GVHD, this steroid-requiring febrile syndrome, hepatic VOD, which we really see very little of. So when that happens, it's eye-catching. And really other odd immune-mediated adverse reactions. So we're all grappling with how much of a washout is appropriate for these patients. The problem is, and Jose and I were talking about this, the problem is these patients are usually third or fourth or fifth or sixth line therapy, and so you don't want to give them a huge gap, but you don't want to commit them to any of these really life-threatening side effects of transplant. So more will come on that, and those of you who are referring these patients to transplant, you really need to be aware of where this falls out so that you're doing your timing appropriately with your transplant center. So key takeaways here, second line and beyond therapy, we now have options, right? We never used to have options. So we can get people into remission and get them to allotransplant, lots of trials, more patients on lots and lots of therapy. So again, all of you in the room continuing to educate. This is really where shared decision making is critical, right? Because out of the gate, there's not a lot of discussion about shared decision making, or because there really aren't buffets of options initially. But once you get to this point, you know, you really need to be involving your patients so they can choose which therapy they think is going to work best for their lives. Looking for side effects and getting on toxicity pretty quickly. So we're going to do some case studies here now. This is a 25-year-old female with newly diagnosed favorable risk classical Hodgkin. So you're thinking about her, and this is not in any specific order, but you're thinking about fertility, right? She's 25. She's got early stage, and so we talked about radiation being a key part of the treatment of early stage patients. So you're worried about breast radiation, you're worried about pulmonary toxicity. This is somebody who is hopefully going to live a normal lifespan. You're worried about long-term toxicities. And then this whole psychosocial thing for these folks who are young. You know, they're in college, they've just finished college, they've gotten their first job, maybe they're starting families. This is something that we don't see every day in our clinical areas. So fertility. The 5-year survival rate, like we talked about, is 85%. Very few females will have premature ovarian insufficiency, which is early menopause, from ABVD. About 10% of males will not have a normal sperm count a year out. So this is not a horrendous regimen for fertility. The problem is we don't know who's going to relapse or who's going to be refractory, right? So that's the problem here. Once they get to transplant, the rate of fertility dysfunction gets very high. Abdominal radiation for females, you know, zapping ovaries, and the same for men with testicular radiation. And really, why do we care? So there are big social and psychosocial impacts for people. This really impacts their quality of life. So what are options? So for women, you know, you can put them on birth control to try to shut that factory down a little bit while, you know, while they're getting chemo. You can harvest eggs. You can do embryo cryopreservation. You can do ovarian tissue cryopreservation. The problem is this takes time. And other than our first option there, they're invasive, right? So, you know, you don't really have a lot of time with these people unless they're very, very early stage. They usually need to get through a cycle or two to get all this stuff done. You may or may not have time to do it. With men, sperm banking, it's easy. You know, you all have a mechanism to get sperm banking done, and that's, you know, that can be done in a matter of days. But there is a lot of research going into pre-puberty boys and trying to figure out how to preserve their fertility, because there are not good options for those unless you're in pediatrics, you don't see them. So what do you need to do? You need to educate. So the risk is low, but all females should be referred. Hopefully you have a GYN that you work with who likes to see these patients. I mean, there are careers to be made in this, in these areas for sure. Lots of papers to be written. If your young woman is getting ABVD, they're probably not going to do anything. Cryopreservation is considered if it's a much higher risk. The chemo has much higher risk of premature ovarian insufficiency. Anybody who's going to transplant, hopefully they've had that discussion before and it's all taken care of. But sometimes you get people who come to you and they no one's ever spoken to them about it. And all males should be offered sperm banking. Pulmonary toxicity. So this is a big deal in Hodgkin's because of bleomycin. So it can be, or it can happen early, it can happen late. It's pulmonary fibrosis, and those are the drugs. The bleomycin is the biggest offender, but certainly the more therapy folks have had, the higher the incidence of pulmonary fibrosis. VOD, pulmonary VOD, again, very common, commonly seen with bleomycin and busulfan, which would be more of your transplant patients. Pleural effusions with busulfan and thoracic radiation. We certainly have a lot of these folks getting their chests radiated. And then, you know, bronchiolitis obliterans, you know, none of these are good to have. But they happen, you need to be looking for them, you need to dose reduce. You're typically going to put them on steroids. You're going to do imaging, you're going to work this up. Hopefully you've got good pulmonary colleagues that are going to help you too. Second malignancies. So these numbers are big. They were sort of shocking to me. So for patients with a history of Hodgkin lymphoma, and remember that first slide we showed you, there are almost 200,000 Hodgkin survivors in this country. They have a much higher risk of second malignancy than the general population. 1 in 5 of Hodgkin survivors will develop a second cancer in the first 20 years after their treatment. The alkylators are the biggest risk for acute leukemia and MDS. And of course, the older you are, the more heavily pretreated you are, the heavily treated you are. But within radiation fields, and this is where the young women come in, breast radiation below 30 is a big red flag. But patients can develop, anybody who's gotten radiation to their chest can develop lung cancer, thyroid cancer, stomach cancer, sarcomas. So this is really a big deal for these patients, and they need to know about this for long-term health planning. So follow-up care, they should be avoiding smoke at all levels. Women who do get chest radiation before 30, and really in my shop, our radiation oncologist essentially will not do it. So, but you can find somebody who'll do anything, right? So women treated with chest radiation before the age of 30 should get early breast cancer screening. And this is really important for these women to know. So 5 to 8 years post-radiation or age 25, breast exams, mammograms, and yearly breast MRIs. So this is really an important part of their survivorship care plans and their primary cares, their GYNs. I don't know that GYNs know this. I don't know that they even know this if we're not telling them. So the patient gets ABVD, no radiation, tolerates it well, complete response. So hopefully she's one of those 85% that are disease-free in 5 years.
Okay, let's try to if we can get through these older cases. This actually is a little bit more challenging population. The 68-year-old male treated with ABVD for classical Hodgkin lymphoma 3 years ago and arrives for a regular scheduled follow-up visit. That's a thing that actually the young adults, they don't do a lot, they follow up. But anyway, it's a little bit different. He remains in complete remission. However, he was recently diagnosed with high blood pressure, have to have a marginal ejection fraction of 45% on an echocardiogram, feels fatigued since chemotherapy is likely worsening recently, slightly elevated creatinine of 1.5, normal hematocrit, hemoglobin, and TSH. He is asking about correlation with chronic Hodgkin lymphoma therapy. So one thing that I can tell you is that, and one thing that we are, if you have not already noticed, what we are emphasizing right now in these cases is both the acute toxicity but the late toxicity. So the survivorship care of these patients is extremely important. Why? Because fortunately, we're curing these patients in a high percentage. So we need very cognizant of our survivorship care plans. So one, cardiotoxicity. We're all familiar with the cardiotoxicity with anthracyclines. It can be all those modalities up there. It can include, may occur during, shortly after, or years after your treatment. Often, unfortunately, non-reversible. The anthracyclines, doxorubicin, daunorubicin, and so forth, is in Hodgkin lymphoma, mainly doxorubicin. Usually when you have an accumulated dose between 450 and 550 milligrams per meter square, I can tell you in Hodgkin, even if you, there's some calculations that if you give up to 8 cycles of ABVD, you get a cumulative dose of 400 milligrams per meter square. Nobody gives 8 cycles of ABVD. So if you think about it, it's not a lot of anthracycline that you're accumulating, but you have to be cognizant, especially in older adults. Chest radiation, it does increase cardiotoxicity, but in a different way. Especially chest radiation increases the risk for early or premature coronary artery disease, valvulopathies as well. So we need to be also watching these patients for this. Consider, you can, prevention strategies, you can consider less toxic agents or, for example, liposomal agents like liposomal doxorubicin. I've never used that on Hodgkin lymphoma, but to be honest with you. And consider late EF monitoring. In some regimens, in older patients, they can consider, we can consider an echocardiogram at the beginning and at the end of ABVD therapy. And there are some cardio-oncology guidelines that you can follow, and hopefully in a lot of your institutions, you have now cardio-oncologists that are, they're a big, big, big help for a lot of our patients. Renal toxicity, the glomerular, you can have glomerular and tubular damage, most of the time subclinical, but may progress to a chronic renal failure. Usually we see on our salvage regimens that include platinums, carboplatin, cisplatin, some of the immunosuppressive agents as well, anti-infectives, one that we love to use. We give like candy sometimes that is acyclovir. Remember, you can have renal toxicity, so you have to be careful about that. And also patients with comorbidities, uncontrolled high blood pressure, diabetes, so forth. There are really no protective agents for these renal toxicities. And as always, of course, avoid polypharmacy, especially in older folks. Monitor the renal function. And obviously reduce appropriate doses of our chemotherapies when they are appropriate. Fatigue, very important in survivorship of these patients. Up to 67, almost 70% of patients with survivors of Hodgkin lymphoma, they complain about fatigue. It's a higher incidence in older patients, no correlation with any other risk factors. Common things are common and obvious things are obvious. Encourage physical activity. These patients will get better with physical activity. And evaluate also for treatment, especially fatigue, very non-specific, but can be one of the signs of disease progression or relapse. So we need to keep that on our radar. And also evaluate for other psychosocial, psychiatric issues only. It could be just depression of the patient. Patient in this case, the patient was evaluated by cardiology. He was started on an ACE inhibitor, beta blocker, and diuretic. Sodium restrict diet, blood pressure was under control, creatinine stayed the same. Energy was low, but it was back to baseline. So it's just to point out that the care of these patients in the long run.
Okay, case study three is a 57-year-old male. He's receiving Biocop for stage four newly diagnosed Hodgkin. His IPS score is 5, so he's over 45. He's a man, stage 4, low hemoglobin, and low absolute lymphocyte count. So his 5-year survival is 42%, which is why he got stepped up to a more aggressive regimen. He presents on day 8 with a low ANC and a fever. He's orthostatic. You're going to admit him. I'm going to whip through this. All of you are treating these patients. You know what to do. Hand washing, watch their counts, safe food handling, appropriate use of growth factors and anti-infectives. And the difference here is that he's getting Biocop, so growth factors are definitely more enfolded into that regimen, as well as the anti-infectives than ABVD. Everybody should get their flu shot and their other age-appropriate vaccinations. Antimicrobial prophylaxis, I'm going to let you guys read this. Antibacterial, antiviral, antifungal. Follow your guidelines, follow your ASCO guidelines, your NCCN guidelines. You guys know how to do this. So he gets admitted for febrile neutropenia. He's empiric antibiotics are started, no source, fever resolved, you know, the typical discharged on orals, and he's got no further fevers. So let's go to number 4. I'm going to whip through this.
Go ahead.
Jose, 42-year-old male with multiply relapsed Hodgkin, including auto, working full-time remotely from home, 3 little kids at home. He's getting Pembro. He's got an excellent partial response, and he is getting worked up for allo at your transplant center. He arrives for his infusion. Everybody has a GI virus. They're vomiting. They have diarrhea. No, they're not vomiting. They have diarrhea. They're nauseated. They have diarrhea. You culture him. His vitals are good. You're going to hold his treatment and let him ride out this virus. He's going to contact you if anything strange is going on, and he comes back in a week. Cultures are negative. He's now having 10 watery stools a day, and you know, 42 is like the new 18, I think. this is grade 3 colitis. He's hypotensive and tachycardic. He's got a little cough. You're not treating him. He's going to get admitted. But he has to get to transplant. He doesn't want to get admitted. He doesn't want anything to throw him off. And you know, they're like this. These men who think they're invincible are like this. So you talk to him, and you talk to him about the life-threatening potential of this toxicity he's having. He needs to be hydrated beyond what your clinic can support him through. And he needs to get worked up so you can get this turned around. And then, really, there's a real rate of interruption for toxicity. And I think if patients understand that out of the gate, then they're not so frightened and they're not so reluctant to tell you what's really going on. His wife tells him, get in the hospital. He gets a colonoscopy done, steroids, rehydration. It all turns around. It's deemed an immune-related adverse event. And then, because he was in a very good partial response, he was ready to go to allo. We didn't have to give him any more Pembro before his allo, so he got a little washout period. He is now, or at the time, he was 60 days post-transplant. He's farther than that now. Little bits of skin GVH, really did fine, did not have any of those horrific toxicities. He tolerated it well. He's working part-time from home. He's very happy. So we have a minute and 23 seconds left. So follow up. I'm just going to do bullet points here. So TSH, if radiation, you're only repeating PET scans if the PET scan was positive. That's the only time you're going to repeat them and do serial PET scans. Once you get a negative PET scan, don't go back to them. You're just looking for false positives. Counseling, okay, screening, this COG chest x-rays, PFTs, in patients who have gotten lung radiation or any of those high-risk alkylators, bleomycin, yearly pulmonary exams. Mm-hmm. Again, get your flu vaccine. Cardiovascular symptoms can occur at a very young age. Again, this is where your primary cares come into play and those survivorship care plans become so important. Because look at these stress echoes, carotid ultrasounds. I mean, these are not things that you're doing with a 35 or 40-year-old. Lipids, TSH, breast screening. So this annual breast screening, this is for women who are over 30 who have gotten chest radiation or axillary. So even your older women who get chest radiation, they do need different breast screening. Again, MRIs, you know, really referring them to someone who sees these patients all the time is a great idea. And then they need to get their other routine screening done, especially these younger folks. They seem to think the cancer card hit them once, it's not gonna hit them again, and they become very complacent with their follow-up. They feel like they've had their lifetime of doctor's visits and they're done. And then survivorship clinics. Who has a survivorship clinic or runs a survivorship clinic? Yay, okay, good. These are perfect referrals. Do you refer these people to your survivorship clinics? Who does that? Good, okay, wonderful. Yep, yes, we should all have a survivorship clinic. So in summary, Hodgkin treatment side effects are expected. They're potentially severe. There are immediate, late, and long-term side effects that we really need to be aware of and focusing on for these patients. Diligent management at all phases really helps reduce the severity and the impact on quality of life for these patients. Their education is critical. The sooner they're reporting things, the less severe they become. Good communication with primary care providers and other specialists is critical. And all of us in this room are really in a unique position to get into that inner sanctum of that patient and figure out what's happening with them, but then also referring and making sure that everybody on their care team is aware of the red flags that need to be monitored long-term. Okay. Here's our questions again.
Just one, two things, a couple of from things to think about Hodgkin lymphoma in your own practice. I just want to close up with these take-home points that I believe are very important. One of them, remember, guys, we're curing 80% plus of these patients. So it's an excellent time to be treating these patients and to follow them through treatment. This is the type of patient that you can see them in college, graduating, making a family, and so forth. So it's very gratifying to treat the patient when they go well. But the 20% of patients, remember, there's still patients that are very challenging. Second of all, do not, in a healthy young patient, do not, even if they have persistent disease after salvage therapy, even half of those patients can get cured without a transplant, okay? So remember to refer the patient early on for an auto transplant in the salvage setting. Third of all, patients that progress after transplant, or if they're not eligible for transplant, they go on to receive brentuximab or checkpoint inhibitors, these patients really, really, really well. Third of all, we don't know when to stop a checkpoint inhibitors in patients that are doing really well, but allo has never died in this disease. And last thing, if you have difficult patients, especially male, talk to the wife, all right? They will come, sorry.
Okay.
Okay, now it's your turn.
Does anybody have any questions?
Question over there.
And I just want to thank all of you for hanging in here. And you all look alert. Good work.
Especially now, Friday night.
Yeah, so. Friday night.
You had mentioned with infliximide, you should not give it for hepatitis.
So usually you don't give it, but sometimes it's not that useful. And actually sometimes can induce a little bit of hepatic injury, but I believe it's not that useful. We usually use for steroids, of course, you know, high-dose steroids, and we use to MMF, like mycophenolate, for the most part, but that's what you usually said. And actually, in the new, oh, by the way, yeah, there are new ASCO guidelines from this year for the managing of checkpoint inhibitors, side effects, and so forth, and that's one of the pearls that I got from it, you know, for the only one, you know, hepatitis. That's the only one that I saw with infliximab.
You had mentioned about liposomal doxy. Why do we not see that used?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I don't know. They have never, on the studies that I know of from Hodgkin lymphoma, especially frontline therapy, it has never been tested. There are some salvage regimens that they put in a big box of Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin patients that they later take to transplant. That has been used, but I do not believe in any one of those big phase three randomized studies have been used with liposomal doxorubicin, really. But I don't know why have not they done that. Maybe because it's not a lot, especially with ABBD, and actually with BCOP as well, it's not a lot of anthracyclines that we give to that population. It's usually, like I say, usually way less than 400 milligrams per meter square, and they're usually younger folks. So I think that the interest has not been there. I might say so, but...
I've used it once in Hodgkin's. It was a 85-year-old with an EF of about 35%. And it was before we had Nevo and Pembro and some of these more interesting things. This was a while back, but when you really are between a rock and a hard place. But I mean, there's no data, which is sort of, you know, it's because we're not maxing folks out.
Mm-hmm. I have two questions, actually. One is about bleo and oxygen. We have used bleo and oxygen with people that pass their pulmonary function tests and their diffusion to try to get two cycles in. Do you say never?
Well, you used to have to do that, but now you don't have to. Now you can give brentuximab with AVD. You don't have to do it. You don't have to risk it.
So you'd be better. Okay.
Yeah.
And then my other question is sort of general, just... one of our referring institutions lets people get Shingrix twice and then stop acyclovir for myeloma-suppressed patients. What are you guys doing with Shingrix in your survivors or your actively treated patients?
Well, actually, for patients who are quote-unquote cure survivors, I really don't have a... Okay, let me back up a little bit. I usually don't use a lot of acyclovir in these patients, especially for my young patients, unless they have a clear history of shingles in the past, and you know sometimes a very bad chickenpox and things like that. But usually I don't use it because this regimen is not a very T cell suppressant, if I might say so. But if you want to use that, especially in the older folks, in patients who are quote unquote cure and remission, I don't believe there's data. There's data in multiple myeloma, a little bit, but not that much. So like abstracts, you know, and in CLL. But in Hodgkin, I mean, it's hard to say. I think I potentially would use it, especially if you're long time after treatment and so forth. But I don't have a very solid answer for that. I think I will potentially use it, but.
Good question, thank you. Does anybody else have questions? Okay, well, thanks for spending Friday night with us.
Thank you very much.